Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's soul food. Now, some think of it as the culinary calling card of African Americans. Or is that a racist idea? And where did this soul thing come from anyway? We talk with history professor Frederick Opie. He's written Hog and Hominy, Soul Food from Africa to America. Well, there's a new stimulation package, the Stern's Twofer at McBob's in Milwaukee. More great news. Good, cheap wine is at an all-time high. Food and Wine's Ray Isle has that story. Then Spanish chef Jose Andres talks the glory of the egg. No country finesses that little ovoid like Spain. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. Well, today we've got an odd juxtaposition. Great poverty and struggle that gave America some of its best eating. This is soul food, and history professor Frederick Douglass Opie has tracked its story in his book Hog and Hominy, Soul Food from Africa to America. He is director of the African Diaspora Studies Program at Marist College. Now, according to Food and Wine magazine's Ray Isle, we are in prime time when it comes to low-priced good wine. Chef Jose Andres talks the Spanish way with eggs. Then it's where sex and personality might meet, in a wine bottle. We talk with Pinot Noir winemaker Susan Doyle of McMurray Ranch. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252 or online, splendidtable.org. So let's get rolling with Jane and Michael Stern of roadfood.com.
Lynn, we've got a twofer for you today. It's in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which, as you know, as everyone knows, is a place to go for a great Friday night fish fry. Every restaurant in Milwaukee, whatever its ethnic background, has a Friday night fish fry. However, the restaurant we're going to talk about is called McBob's, and they not only have a great, one of the great Friday night fish fries, it is also a source of one of the best corned beef sandwiches anywhere in the Midwest, maybe anywhere in the country.
Michael, that's... is twofer like part of the Stern stimulus package?
Yes.
You know, the idea of the best corned beef sandwich in the country. I'm a former New Yorker, and them there is fighting words.
We can't tell you a thing, I know. No, the thing is, Lynn, you would appreciate this corned beef sandwich as a New Yorker because unlike a lot of the corned beef that you get in the Midwest, which tends to be sliced very, very thin, you know, almost shaved, McBob's serves a real chunky kind of corned beef, and it's hand-sliced, you know, not machine-sliced. Corned beef like you'd get like at Katz's Deli and you know, downtown New York. And it's just, I have to say, even more than any place in New York, it is so tender. I mean, it's got that pot roast quality of like if you just probe it with a fork, it starts falling apart.
There are two no-nos for corned beef on my mind. One is I don't like the thinly shaved kind.
Hey, I'm like, a Chicagoan,
yeah, I know,
Jay. You can't
I
say
know.
That.
I don't like the thinly shaved kind. And I don't like lean corned beef. I like a nice big hunk of fat on the outside of it. I mean, I think you just, you know, even if you eat one corned beef sandwich every decade, it has to be fatty and hand-cut.
Well, let me say, though, that, I mean, McBob's corned beef, while I wouldn't call it lean, neither is it fatty. It's one of those great corned beefs
juicy,
where the fat has just saturated every fiber of the meat. So even if you're not actually eating a piece of fat, the meat itself is just drippingly good.
But that makes a lot of sense. Now, is this place a bar? What is this place?
Yes.
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 Oh,
you,
of course.
You know, ordinarily, you know, road food is not found in taverns. Milwaukee is one of the big exceptions to this rule. McBob's is a drinking person's bar. You go there on a Friday night and you've got a huge crowd of, you know, thank God it's Friday people mm-hmm. drinking shots and beers. And in fact, at the Fish Fry, you know, the traditional...
It's not a yuppie bar.
No, it's not. But the libation to have with your fried fish and great potato pancakes is a bottle of beer and a shot of whiskey.
This sounds fab. I'm just thinking, you know, a corned beef sandwich as a starter... and then you could do an intermezzo of the potato pancake and then move on to the fish fry. Or you could
Either way is fine. However, you have to make plans to come back the next morning because, believe it or not, even though McBob's is a tavern, they make some absolutely tremendous corned beef hash
every morning. That was coming, and I have not had a good corned beef hash in 20 years.
It is sensational corned beef
hash. How many miles away from Milwaukee are you?
Too far.
300?
Too far. Yeah, but you know what? I could do this on my tricycle, for goodness sakes. I mean, this sounds good.
Work up an appetite, right?
Hey, thanks, guys.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
One of Jane and Michael Stern's life-changing tomes is Two for the Road. Now, you know the Sterns are here every week, but you don't have to wait a week to get their food finds. You can just check them out on the website, splendidtable.org. We got an email from a listener last week asking about pasta shapes. The question was, how do you know which shape to use when the recipe doesn't specify it? Well, this is not an evil plot launched by Italian pasta companies. There are actual reasons for different shapes. Now think about this. If a pasta recipe calls for penne, which is that tubular, short, stubby pasta, it means that the sauce is a substantial one. So you need a substantial pasta, something that can hold up against the sauce. Now, you could substitute other sturdy pastas like farfalle, rigatoni, or fusilli without any problem. Now, if angel hair is called for, which is the super fine string pasta, you need a delicate thin pasta. So use spaghettini, tagliarini, or even vermicelli. Just remember that the chunkier and the gutsier the sauce, the bigger and more ridged or curved you want the pasta shape to be. The more delicate and broth-like the sauce, the finer and the lighter the pasta should be. Is a former creative writing teacher who has somehow wangled a life out of wine. Now, the good news is that he knows how lucky he is, and he puts those writing skills to good use as wine editor at Food & Wine magazine. Hey, Ray, welcome back.
It's great to be back, Lynn. Thanks.
Ray, is there any truth in something I heard, that we have never had this much good, inexpensive wine available before?
I think it's absolutely true. I think that for a long time, a lot of the regions that are now producing extraordinarily good value wines suffered from kind of sketchy winemaking or, you know, weird quality control. And I think technology, in a sense, has caught up to the potential of the region. And so you're getting just terrific wines under $20 from most places that grow grapes. Southern France is a case in point. It's a vast ocean of vines down there, and there was a lot of so-so wine that came out of there, let's say, in the 60s. But now you can get these stunning wines for under $20. People tend to think of French wine as being pricey, and lot of the southern, a lot of the stuff from the south is not pricey at all, and it's really wonderful.
What should we look for?
Well, I like to look for one kind of key trick is to look for affordable wines from really sort of star producers, in a sense. One wine I like a lot is the 2007 Perrin Reserve Côte du Rhône Blanc. Which is about, I mean, suggested retail is about 13. Odds are you can find it for $11.99 or something like that. It's a minerally crisp, sort of smoky white wine, fairly full-bodied, not as big as a California Chardonnay, but, you know, a fairly rich wine. But the Perrin family is primarily known for Chateau Beaucastel, which is a $100 Chateau Neuf de Pape that's kind of the benchmark Chateau Neuf de Pape of the world. And so they've taken all that winemaking knowledge they have and applied it to making affordable wines. And the result is pretty spectacular. It's a really nice wine.
You know, it's so nice they've become so democratic.
Yes, it is. Wine is not, you know, wine except in the U.S. has this idea that wine is this sort of fancy thing only to be served at special events.
Right.
Whereas most of the world, and particularly Europe, wine is the most everyday drink you can imagine.
Well, water was so dangerous for so long. I mean,
yeah, water would kill you.
So what about South America?
There are so many values coming out of South America right now. One place I particularly like is the coast. I mean, most of Chile is a coast because Chile is only about 12 miles wide or something.
Yeah.
But that the vineyards that are right along the edge of the sort of extreme edge of the country, right on the Pacific, get this cold wind off the Pacific, and they're really good for white wines, particularly Sauvignon Blanc. They make incredibly crisp, minerally tangy Sauvignon Blancs. One of the ones I like a lot is the 2008 Montes Classic Sauvignon Blanc. It's about, suggested is about 13. Realistically, you're going to find it for, $10.99 or something.
Right, right.
And what I love about it is it's got this, kind of electrify-your-mouth citrus note to it. And it's got a little of that Sauvignon Blanc greenness, grassiness, but it's not over the top to the point of being green pepper, jalapeno pepper. It's more like fresh-cut grass. And, it's just a great, crisp, start-the-meal kind of Sauvignon Blanc that is all over the place, too.
I'm thinking that's the kind of wine that's great for a lot of the things we eat these days.
Absolutely. I mean, for anything, especially something like sushi or any light, crisp kind of food, salads. Sauvignon Blanc's one of the few wines that goes well with a vinaigrette on a salad.
It's that acidity.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of counterintuitive because you'd think you'd want something big and rich to counter the acidity. But in fact, the acidity of the vinaigrette is so intense that you lose all the flavors unless you have an acidic wine.
So another one.
Another one. Spain. I'm a huge Spanish wine fan. But where I've been looking for values lately is essentially all of Spain's Mediterranean coast, sort of from Barcelona on down. And you've got that warm Mediterranean sun, and you've got a tremendous amount of old vines that never got torn out basically during the Franco era that are still there from the 1920s and so on. And they produce terrific red wines for a very good price. One of the ones I like, a completely ridiculous name but an actually fairly good wine, is the 2007 Rongo Dongo.
You've got to be kidding.
I kid you not. That is its name.
Rongo Dongo?
Rongo Dongo.
Okay.
What the importer was thinking, I don't know. but it's an $8 suggested retail price. It's affordable. And it's made from Monastrell, which is kind of one of the classic grapes of the region. The French call it Mouved. And it's, if you think of just really ripe blackberries, it's juicy, it's plump, it's got a lot of dark fruit flavor. And it's, is it the most complex wine on the planet? No. But is it juicy and delicious to drink? Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And plus, it's got a ridiculous name. So how can you beat that?
And it has a wonderful price, $8. And I love this.
It does have a wonderful price. I mean, you can't beat that.
Ray, thank you. This is a gift.
I'm happy to supply those gifts anytime.
Ray Isle is wine editor at Food & Wine magazine. Now, to find information on his global wine picks and a recipe to go with them, my classic pizza margarita, hit the website splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to also check out all our other offerings. Our newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, our podcast, info on our book, How to Eat Supper, and our latest brainchild, something we're calling Splendid Cheap Eats, a collection of inexpensive recipes culled from our archive. And by the way, that pizza margarita is one of them. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Coming up, the soul in soul food, the irrepressible Jose Andres, and sex and personality in a wine bottle. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Ah, soul food. Now, you've heard the expression hundreds of times. It conjures ribs, fried chicken, sweet potato pie. Soul food is African-American food. But where did the term come from? And is the image of soul food seen as insulting? For Frederick Douglass Opie, soul food is how he traced the history of African Americans from West Africa in the 1600s to sit-ins at lunch counters in the 1960s. Frederick Douglass Opie is Associate Professor of History and Director of the African Diaspora Studies Program at Marist College. His book is Hog and Hominy, Soul Food from Africa to America. Frederick, welcome.
Thank you.
You know, this may seem to belabor the obvious, but how did the soul get into soul food?
How did the soul get into the food?
Yeah.
Well, soul has a long connection with people of African descent that I argue goes all the way back to African tribes and kingdoms. So, you know, when I talk about what is soul, which was something that I had to dig up, I could not find a lot of sources that did that. So my argument is that soul is a cultural mixture of various African tribes and kingdoms, and then also that soul is spirituality that's tied all the way back to these African tribes and kingdoms. When you see ceremonies, what may be just a devotional ceremony to the gods or to the ancestors, if you're talking about marriage, which is also a spiritual ceremony, when somebody becomes the head of a tribe or an mm-hmm. elder, those are all spiritual ceremonies, and they all are connected to distinctive foods, which we can trace all the way up to the 1960s, 1970s, and what people are eating in African-American communities.
So when did this term, soul food, become popular in modern times?
I connect it with the Black Power movement of the 1960s, 1970s, and I argue that Black Power championed the development of distinct Black consciousness, that is, African history, clothing, hairstyle like the Afro, soul music that we're all familiar with, but also food.
But, you know, I guess the thing that I wonder about is this seen as something that is almost racist or insulting by some people?
Well, if you talk about what goes on within the African-American community itself, it's something that's celebrated along with music and culture. I'll give you an example. I was at a St. Patrick's Day parade in Tarrytown, New York, where I live.
Mm-hmm.
And the highlight of the parade was the very last band, which was this all Black and some Hispanic members from Brooklyn. And they came down and they were sashaying and they had soul. And everybody on the side of that street, and you know, most of the people in the audience were white Americans from that town, and they loved it and ate it up. So I don't see it as pejorative. And those of us who were African Americans on the side watching it, we reveled. We had so much pride when we saw them come down the street shaking their soul.
There's this fine line, isn't there, between cultural identity and the idea of typecasting. And
yeah, it is. You know, it's a fine line between stereotyping and celebrating. And I think it's funny. I think every culture celebrates that which identifies them ethnically, but don't want outsiders celebrating or identifying them that way. So it could be kind of a tight walk.
Now, does this mean that white people can't do soul food? I mean,
Absolutely not. You know, people used to say that Elvis Presley was a soul brother, you know, because he understood the culture. When you grow up around African Americans, whether it be in the South or the North or wherever you're from, you're going to pick up that culture. You're going to pick up that soul, that uniqueness. And I think that's the same with African Americans that grow up around other cultures. You will pick up that which you're surrounded by.
You know, I realize we're talking about this thing called soul food. Most people think they know what the dishes are or what the food mm-hmm. is, but I'd love to hear it from you.
Well, I say that soul food is the culinary adaptations and values developed during the antebellum period and thereafter. So if you look at what was given to enslaved people as rations, things like salt pork, If you look at rice, if you're in the mm-hmm. low country, South Carolina and Georgia, it depends on where you are. But a lot of those rations were given to you make up part. You know, how do you recreate your African heritage and culture within this new environment? So that's one aspect. The other aspect is, what are you able to grow yourself within this in this new world environment as an enslaved person? So you get the collard greens. What are you able to catch yourself? So you get a lot of the things like with a small game like squirrel, a different game that's right. become a part of soul food, like rabbit, fried rabbit. Then soul food also is cookery inspired by both the residents of the big house, that is the master class, and also the plantation quarters, that there's a dialectic that happens between both. Because who is cooking in the residence of the master? It's enslaved people. And what are they cooking with? Ingredients that are provided by enslaved people. And they bring that back to the slave quarters. So there's a constant dialectic in relationship between the enslaved and the master class.
The thing that I found so interesting, too, that you mentioned in the book, going way back to West Africa, was mm-hmm. that the food of the original peoples was so influenced by the Arab influence in North Africa, by things that were happening in Spain. So this mix has always been going on.
Yeah, Africans have always been a trading people. And the trade that happens across West Africa to North Africa and into the Iberian Peninsula, particularly as the Moors were controlling the Iberian Peninsula for almost 800 years. So if you look at the period from 711 to 1400, when the Moors were there, they are constantly carrying on trade with Africans. So the culinary trade is part of that influence that ends up in African and African cooking.
You know, I'm thinking about that period before desegregation, when blacks and whites did not sit in a restaurant generally together or were in different parts of a place. But white people were eating black folks' food, right?
Of course. You know, I say to people that I don't find much of a difference when I did the study between what black folks in the South were eating and the white folks. And this is the situation. If you were a white person and you had money, who's cooking for you? A black person. Mm-hmm. If you were a white person and you didn't have money, who are you living next to? Black folks. So you're going to be influenced by black cooks and culinary experts in one shape or the other, no matter if you're wealthy or if you're poor.
It's fascinating, the sort of roundabout journey this food has taken. Frederick, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
History professor Frederick Douglass, OP, is author of Hog and Hominy, Soul Food from Africa to America. These days, we're all looking for a new idea for inexpensive and good eats. And while we all tend to associate chefs with fancy, high-end dishes, I think we forget how much they know about stretching the dollar. Well, we invited Chef Jose Andres to join me today. His latest book is Made in Spain, Spanish Dishes for the American Kitchen. Jose, it's good to have you back.
So happy to be here, Lynn.
So, Jose, I want to get into the Spanish way with eggs.
Well, eggs in Spain, you know, every time I bring someone to Spain and they've been with me for more than 3, 4, 5 days,
yeah,
everyone will always tell me, wow, Jose, did you notice that you serve eggs for breakfast, lunch, and dinner? I say, oh, sure, I notice. So everyone that comes from far away and come to Spain, they will notice that eggs are very much part of our culture. And we love eggs. And I want to believe that we love them so much today because we need to remember that less than 30, 40 years ago, mm-hmm. Still under Franco times, and these are stories I will listen to my mother and my father, they will tell me when the eggs was something like you will not be dreaming of having this beautiful egg dish because it was very rare, was very expensive. And we forget that today we are taking things for granted. Today, eggs are something are ready and available and can feed mm-hmm. entire families. But not too long ago in Spain was something seen as something only for the rich and powerful.
So give me some ideas of some of the dishes that are done with eggs in Spain.
Well, I can almost explain you the history of my childhood through the different egg dishes I ate as I grow older. The first one was... It's pure simplicity. When I was probably 5, 6, 7 years old, my mother will give us every other day two or 3 days per week. At the end of the meal, one egg yolk with a full spoon of sugar, mixed raw, and we will eat it like this. When there was not an issue on salmonella, and when the eggs still, they were not required to be in the refrigerator. Always I saw eggs outside the refrigerator. We need to remember that the eggshell is the most amazing natural protector that we have in nature. So that's one of the first egg experiences I remember, the egg yolk raw with sugar.
So what comes to mind next?
Well, next goes back again to sweets. And this is very interesting because I do believe my mother made this omelette, this time with the whole egg, more sugar again, olive oil, and she will make a sweet egg omelette. And you are going to be thinking, wow, a sweet omelette feeding the children. Well, we need to remember that back almost in the 14th century in Europe, even savory dishes, they were always having sugar or honey added to them. I guess this is history keep moving. But you know, one of the dishes, really, if you ask my three brothers or you ask many people in Spain, that if you ask them, what's your favorite egg dish? And many people in Spain or cookbooks will not tell you this is a Spanish dish. But actually, everyone had at least once a week that dish on their home. That dish is called huevos a la cubana, Cuban-style eggs. And this, I guess, comes from the Spanish-American War, when, you know, Spain still had very much all the islands in the Caribbean until we lost the last one, and Cuba was one of those islands. And then one of the dishes that you find today in every home will be this very special fried egg. That's why we have so much olive oil in Spain, white rice, beautiful tomato sauce, and then a great ground pork sausage. Sometimes a piece of banana, bringing this kind of Latin influence into the dish. This mix of banana, tomato, rice, and egg, all perfectly, very crispy egg white on the edges, all mixed together, will be to me an experience I remember today. And I'm very proud to see my three daughters, Ines, Carlota, and Lucia, that today, 4, 7, and 9-year-old, enjoy that dish in the same way I did so many years ago.
Oh, Jose, thank you. I'm so hungry. thank you very much.
That's what we need to be doing in the radio. From now on, you know, we should be eating at the same time.
I will not argue with that. Thank you, sir.
Mwah. Thank you.
Chef Jose Andres is host of PBS's Made in Spain series. Now, you can get Jose's recipe for omelet with white beans and green onions at splendidtable.org.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but you call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
The lines are open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Anything goes. Okay, let's see who is calling. We've got Anne calling in from Arlington, Virginia. Anne, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. It's good to hear your voice. I have a question about juniper berries.
Yeah.
I got about a half a cupful as a gift, and I don't know what to do with them. They are all sort of dark brown and a little bit tacky with I've tasted them, and I thought that they would be really piney, but they're really not even that piney.
Oh.
Can one use them in a marinade or a dry rub?
What do they taste like?
They taste like, well, they don't taste like gin. So they should taste like gin. So they're just
Well, they're used in making gin, you know, essentially. But go ahead.
They taste earthy and a little bit piney, not salty at all.
No.
They're tacky, and they're very strong flavored, but I don't know. Do you grind them up?
Well, usually you crush them.
Right.
So the classics, juniper and game, any kind of game. Juniper with anything that has a robust flavor in terms of meat or fish or poultry. So, for instance, I mean, they're great with chicken and they're excellent with more delicate things, but they really seem to stand out when you do them with things like, oh, for argument's sake, salmon, scallops, bluefish, ham, any kind of pork, duck, goose, that kind of thing.
Okay.
And I mean, I'm not above throwing them into a marinade in my chicken or throwing them into a stew or a soup. And they do have, to me, they always have almost a, I can't quite explain it, as you said, a kind of piney taste, but there's always a peppery menthol quality for me.
Yes.
But the thing with the juniper berry is you want to be careful not to deuce too much. Now, a classic old-time marinade was sour cream or buttermilk with crushed garlic and crushed juniper berries. And you could put anything in that. You could put pork chops in that. You could put, you know, a piece of fish in that or shellfish. In the case of the fish, give it a half hour in the fridge. In the case of something like chicken thigh, for instance, you could do that overnight. And then you might slow roast it, or you might grill it, or you might stew it.
Okay.
But
now, does one crush them, for example,
yeah,
in a mortar and pestle?
Yeah, you'd crush them. You don't have to crush them down a lot. You just want to release more of the flavor. And you could crush them with the garlic and that kind of thing. Now, the other place they're fabulous is with anything made with cabbage.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, for instance, sauerkraut, you brown onion with crushed juniper berry and some apple and some garlic. Unbelievable. Then you drain, you know, you rinse your sauerkraut, you throw that in with some white wine and you let that cook.
Oh, that sounds delicious.
It is so good.
It would be good with red cabbage, too.
It would be fabulous with red cabbage. But what's fun to do then, I mean, this is really getting over the top here, but is to parboil some cabbage leaves and throw that sauerkraut with the onion and the garlic and the juniper berry, roll it up in a cabbage leaf, and then bake it in something like a cream sauce.
Oh, my gosh, that sounds wonderful.
It's really fabulous because of that, you know, salty kind of acidity of the sauerkraut played against, you know, a nice special.
Very German.
Yeah, very German, extremely German. The other thing is roast whole onions. Okay.
Yeah.
And then what you do is crush a little bit of juniper with some green onion or red onion, mix that with a little cream cheese and sour cream. You've roasted the onion in its skin. You've just removed like the top quarter of it.
Right.
And when it's soft so that you can easily stick a knife through it, it's going to be sweet as sugar. Okay.
Oh, that sounds delicious.
What you do is take it out of the oven, let it get to the point where it's warm. With two forks, open the center and drop that mixture in.
Oh, that sounds good. That's some great ideas. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. Enjoy them.
Thank you.
You're going to need another half cup, by the way.
Okay.
Hey, thanks, Ann. You take
Bye.
Care. Bye. You know, if you're wondering what to do with something like juniper, think of where it comes from. It comes from, essentially, it's a member of the pine family, comes from a juniper bush. And think of where do they flourish? Well, they flourish all through Scandinavia. Scandinavian food is great with juniper berries. Most of Germany, all of Northern Europe. So that opens up all these different cuisines. It's kind of fun to think about that when you start working with a spice you don't know very much about. Okay, it is time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what was an Aeneida? Now, we're going to be back with that answer in a moment. And more of your calls, reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to get back to your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what is an Aeneida? Well, an Aeneida was a servant whose only job was to pick up the scraps from the table and its general area after dinner. Now, the job existed in England 500 or 600 years ago. You know that old line about you just can't get good help anymore? Well, if you look at pictures of dining back then, it was obvious that you couldn't get a tidy guest come hell or high water. And Aeneata had to be pretty busy because those pictures showed things just tossed on the floor, you know, bones and scraps. And people still ate off of trenchers, that's slices of hard bread. An Aeneata perk had to be those trenchers because they would be soaked with meat juices and you could sell them on the castle black market, as in to poor folk who waited at the kitchen door for handouts. Credit for this wonderfully arcane bit goes to Janet Clarkson in her blog, The Old Foodie. This woman adores getting into old, and I mean very old, texts, and she's got a delicious sense of humor. So check out The Old Foodie. Okay, back to your calls. Now, you can get to us at 800-537-5252. Let's see, we have got Zach on the line from Minneapolis. Zach, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, I had a question about making bread puddings.
Okay.
I like to make bread puddings, but throughout the different recipes I've seen, there's two different methods for cooking them. And I had a question about which you would prefer and what the difference is and how you do it.
Okay.
Most bread puddings call for a water bath, where you cook the bread pudding in a pan and a bath of water in a larger pan.
Mm-hmm.
But I've noticed that some of them don't require this, and I was wondering what the difference was.
Well, this is the thing. Essentially, a bread pudding is a custard, that is, a mixture of milk and eggs that you've added bread, flavoring, sugar, etc. to. Okay?
Yep.
But it's a custard and bread. Now, a custard, if you cook it by itself, you have to be extremely careful because this is what happens. You have eggs in a suspension in milk. If you cook that over too high heat or you cook it too fast, the eggs kind of, the protein in the eggs just seize up, separate from the milk. And, you know, you've seen those custards that just keep throwing off liquid.
Oh, yeah.
They're overcooked. Okay?
Oh.
Now, one of the ways you avoid that is to use moderate heat and you use a water bath. That is, you put the pan that you have the custard in into a larger pan and you pour in hot water, not boiling, but just hot water, and you put it in the oven. Why do you do that? Because that water usually never even gets to 200 degrees. Your oven may be at 350 or 325, but that water bath keeps that custard cooler so it cooks slowly. And if you cook it too fast, you get that separation. Or if you cook it too long, you get that separation. So
I've had that a few times.
Right. Now, if you have starch in that custard, if you've cooked flour into it or whatever, you don't have to worry generally about a water bath because the starch protects the egg.
Oh.
I mean, you don't want to overcook it, but it's not as fragile. Now, here's the deal. If you have a bread pudding where you have a lot of bread in proportion to custard or where it's been left to sit for a long time so that that pudding has permeated the bread and now it's really eggs and milk and starch, you don't need a water bath. So if you've got a lot of custard and not a lot of bread, I'd use a water bath.
All right. Thank you very much.
Go for it. Thank you.
All right. Bye.
Bye. Call us 800-537-5252. We have got Ellen on the line calling from Rochester, New York. Ellen, what do you want to talk about?
Lynn, I want to talk about how my food looks when it's on the plate. I like to plate the food in the kitchen for a dinner party.
Uh-huh.
And like maybe I'm in a hurry to get things out together or hot, and you know, even though I do pay attention to the balance of color and texture, I feel like it doesn't look great, and it could look better without looking like something that's studied and tied with chive ribbons and things like that. But I wondered if you had any tips about how to make my food look better on the plate.
Well, I think a couple of things come to mind. First of all, allow plenty of room around the food. In so many words, give the food air. And think about what color your plates are. One of the reasons white plates are so popular is that almost everything looks good on them. I mean, I collect plates at garage sales and that kind of thing. And, you know, there are certain things that look great on a pale, pale blue plate. Like a lot of food is brown.
Mm-hmm.
And most brown food looks really nice, an ice blue or very, very pale green. So think about backdrop and don't crowd the plate.
Oh, that sounds good.
And never underestimate one other thing, the little bundle of greens on the plate, whether you're serving family style or you're serving an individual plate. Not a sprig of something, but a little bunch of coriander leaves, a little bunch of rosemary, a little bunch of parsley, just tuck in the middle of everything or off a little bit off kilter from the center. That shot of green, it has to fit with the taste of the meal, but it's fabulous.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, and also remember something else. Finishing dishes with a squeeze of lemon is always a way to bring up flavor. You let your guests do the squeeze.
Oh, just put some lemon on
exactly. Okay. And always think odd numbers. Never pairs.
Okay.
Do three or do five.
Oh, okay.
Of something. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
And don't hesitate also to pluck the leaves from the parsley and just drop it over the top of everything after the plate's arranged.
Yeah, that's such a great idea, and I forget about parsley.
You forget about this, and parsley really tastes great. The other thing is, if you're plating for your guests, it's really important to have the food hot. Have the plates hot.
Oh.
And do not be above asking for help.
Yeah.
You know, I think we tend to do the wonder person routine of I can do this all by myself. Hey, this is what friends are for.
That's true. And I think it relaxes them when you ask someone to help out a little bit.
It relaxes them, and not only that, but if there's somebody new to the group, get someone who's part of the gang with that person in the kitchen and you. Mm-hmm. It gets people involved.
Well, thank you. I love your show.
Thank you for having me on. Hey, Ellen, enjoy.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
Call us, 800-537-5252. We have got Debbie calling from Tacoma, Washington. Debbie, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Good morning, Lynn. How are you?
I am good.
Good. Well, I want to talk about something very special to do with our Northwest cuisine here. But before I do, I want to tell you, Lynn, you have kind of changed my life, and I want to tell you how you do that.
What did I do?
You've changed my life. Well, you know, I'm a busy person, as are so many mothers and people that spend their time running around during the week.
Right.
And on the weekends, I come home, and for the last 20 years or so, I've been doing the same thing, kind of racing around, ruining my weekend by errands and everything that I'm doing to fill up my life. But when your show comes on the weekend, I sit down and I listen to your show and I cook. And I stay in my kitchen and I kind of cook along with Lynn for a couple hours on Sunday afternoon when it airs.
Hey, thank you. Thank you. So Debbie, that warms the cockles of my heart.
Oh, well, it's a wonderful thing. And it makes me slow down and it makes me enjoy my home and enjoy my kitchen. And, you know, I typically cook something fun and interesting and get ready for the week, and that kind of centers me for the rest of the week. So
thank you.
I appreciate your show.
That's a huge compliment.
Well, thank you. Well, what I want to talk about is salmon. My husband is absolutely a salmon-holic. He could literally eat salmon every single day of the week if I allowed him to do that. We are lucky in that we live here about two blocks from Puget Sound, and we do have a boat, and we can catch salmon, and we have access to good salmon. But I'm kind of getting a little tired of it, and I'm getting a little tired of cooking it. So
yeah.
I thought I would see if you had some wonderful new ideas for how to cook salmon.
Ooh. Do you ever poach it?
You know, not very much. I do a lot of grilling, and I do sauté it sometimes, but I don't actually poach it. So tell me how to do that.
Well, the idea of poaching is that you have the liquid barely bubbling. You know, it's not boiling.
Right.
It's shuddering. And it's one of the ways that you get the most delicate, true flavor from whatever you're poaching. And you could do a whole salmon this way. You could do steaks. You could do a fillet this way. Classically, the poaching liquid is white wine and all kinds of vegetables. But one of the things you might want to do is water with something that has an Indian overtone, like crushed cardamom pods.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Doesn't it? And fresh ginger.
Mm-hmm.
And a little garlic if you want. You would simmer that maybe 5 minutes or so, and then you could do this in a skillet. You know, you could do this in a wide pan. You want to do it in a way that you can easily scoop up that salmon and get it out. I use a pancake turner to do that, two pancake turners. And I like salmon steaks just because they're more compact. But here's the idea. You get that water. you simmer it for a bit just to get the flavor out of the flavorings. And then I bring it up to a very gentle bubble. I slip the salmon in or the fish in. And you figure about 3 or 4 minutes. And if you have any doubt, you slip an instant reading thermometer in there to the center of the fish. And when it's at about 125 to 130, yank it out and let it sit for 3 or 4 minutes to finish cooking. Now, once you're done with that, you could serve it hot or you could serve it cold.
Exactly. Oh, it sounds great.
And one of the things that'd be fun to do with that is to do that on a bed of a sauce of whole milk yogurt that you have mixed with more crushed cardamom and some sautéed ginger and garlic, and then squeeze fresh lime over the top of that salmon and have just a little puddle of that combination underneath it with maybe some rice. And you've got this really kind of interesting East Indian overtone. Another thing to do is either take cooked or raw salmon, okay? Mix it with shredded par-cooked potatoes.
Oh, my gosh.
Preferably redskins, you know, the potatoes that are waxy.
Yep.
Some chopped onion, seasoning of any kind. And now pan fry it as little cakes or burgers.
Oh, gosh.
I like to do it with raw salmon because the salmon just cooks. Just you mash it kind of all together and then you put it in just a little oil in the pan, not a lot. Yeah. And then you can serve that with fresh sliced cucumbers that you've mixed with a little in Scandinavian style.
Right.
You know, with onion
and
you know, yeah, well, if not sour cream, you could do it with a mixture of sugar.
Oh, sure. Okay.
And a little vinegar and a little water to dilute it so it's not too sharp. And that can stay in the fridge. You know, those, it's like a pickle almost.
Right.
And you can bring it out. And it's a beautiful contrast to those cakes. So there's two great ideas. Wonderful. See what you can do with that.
Really good ideas.
Debbie, thanks for calling.
All right. Thanks,
take care.
Lynn. Bye. Bye-bye.
What a problem. Too much salmon. Oh. Well, anyway, call us, 800-537-5252. Winemaker Susan Doyle tasted her first good Pinot Noir at 16 on her family's farm in Tasmania. And evidently that did it, because in her 20s, she was crushing Pinot Noir grapes in California. She returned down under to make wine in Australia, and then Gallo called. Gina Gallo wanted Susan to take over a new property, McMurray Ranch. The goal? Make dynamite Pinot Noir and white Pinot Gris. Well, Susan's one of a relatively new kind of winemaker. Susan Doyle, welcome.
Thank you.
You came from Tasmania and Australia to work in California. What did you taste in California that made such a big impact?
I guess coming from a rural background, I grew up on an apple farm. And I'd always had a passion with food and later wine. And coming up here to California, the Pinot Noir that I was working with at the time over on Sonoma Coast, it was just so big and so lush, and it was quite different than what I'd been experiencing both back in Australia and Tasmania.
Interesting. You know, this may be a sexist question, but I remember a wine writer saying that Pinot Noir was the most feminine of grapes. Do you think there's a gender affinity here?
I sometimes question that. It's certainly a finicky grape. I think it's one of the more technically challenging wines to make. And I think perhaps women have a slightly more nurturing patience that comes through. We tend to learn to step back and keep the hands off. But I do know many brilliant, obviously, gentlemen or winemakers.
Do you think that men and women experience taste and aroma differently? Physiologically, there are differences?
Yeah, there's been a lot of interest in that in the last couple of years, and certainly a lot of academic study. But to me, I've often wondered more whether it's not historically based. Obviously, coming up through the generations, I think younger women generally tend to be closer to the kitchen traditionally, whereas the young gentlemen were off frolicking, playing sports and outside, whereas now, traditionally, those roles have started to change. We've moved more back into the city. Younger people are actually moving out on their own earlier, staying single longer, and I'm certainly seeing a lot more young men being more in tune and learning more about food and wine, and I think it's more about learning how to cook and then associate those flavors and aromas back to the wine.
Yeah, I'm wondering, are there certain winemakers, and I'd love to talk about women winemakers because I think you're still a relatively rare breed. Are there certain winemakers that you think their personality shows up in their wines?
Definitely. I mean, I've been so intrigued with different winemakers up here. Obviously, back in Australia, there's quite a few now starting to come up through the ranks, but not as many as we'd like to see. But I think probably Louisa Ponzi up in Oregon, even though she's second generation, she's really doing a wonderful job with some beautiful wines out of the Willamette Valley that her parents obviously started the business. But she's carrying it forward. And I think that's what it's all about. It's about distinguishing yourself as a winemaker, and she's certainly done that, and to keep the honor of terroir and what is coming out of the soil and the climate and the local region. And then I guess for me, somebody else like the lady that heads up Fiddlehead, Kathy, she is an amazing woman down in Santa Rita, and she produces these most amazing Pinot Noir and Sauvignon Blancs. And she's just this wonderful character and very passionate about vineyards. And she has wines that she makes from both Oregon and from the Santa Rita area down near Santa Barbara. And again, I think she likes to let terroir speak, that it's more about the soil and the climate. Mm-hmm. We often laugh in winemaking that it's about terroir or the terra, and terra can be what the winemaker has done to the wine once it's actually been handled as grapes into the winery. And I think it tends to be more that the people that I associate with more tend to back off and just let the wine do what they need to do to produce a beautiful, delicate style that has longevity.
Susan, thank you.
Thanks.
Susan Doyle is winemaker at Gallo's McMurray Ranch. Now, you can find information on the winemakers she mentioned on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from John Maynard Keynes, who said, "My only regret in life is that I did not drink more champagne." The Splendid Table is supported by American Public Media, announcing Krista Tippett's new book, Einstein's God: Conversations About Science and the Human Spirit, available in bookstores now. You'll find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Judy Boudreau and Jennifer Larson. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Brett Baldwin. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.